This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry at work, in relationships, in families, and in the many roles they hold every day. Women have played a strong role in my life. I was raised by a single mother. She worked multiple jobs at once, and I can't imagine how difficult I was to deal with as a child. But somehow, my mom and a village made it work. I'm sure some of our listeners can also think of someone like that in their own lives. Often the strongest people in our lives are usually the ones holding everything together, which also means they are the last ones to get support themselves, or who might need someone to talk to the most. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. And if you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. They also have great client reviews. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy program, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
From lashes for days with the Viral Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara to awakening your eyes with lift and color from the Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is the go-to when you want to amplify your everyday look. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin. And for every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to help communities thrive. So every time you use your favorite Thrive Cosmetics product, you're helping communities you care about, too. Amplify your everyday. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.
How well do you know your neighbor? You know the one that lives across the street? Or right next door to you on the right? You walk outside every morning and you wave at them, they wave back. How well do you truly know them, though? From the outside, they look like any normal person. But how do they act when they go back inside that house? When that house goes quiet? When the television hum fades to static? When the furnace clicks off? When the only sound left is the slow breathing of the people you trust most? Because in Decatur, Illinois, in 1964, evil did not break a window. It did not wear a mask. It did not creep in from the outside. It lived there. It ate dinner at the table. It slept under the same roof. It knew which steps creaked on the stairs. And on one cold Friday night in late February, it walked down into the basement, picked up a hatchet, and came back up. This is American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. I'm your host, Adam White. American Dread is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. I'm going to take you back to a quiet neighborhood with a modest frame house on South 32nd Street in Decatur, Illinois. A house that looked ordinary, with a quiet family that lived inside. A house in which a monster was born. And would give that house its name, the Hatchet House. In 1960, Decatur was home to just over 94,000 people, a small but powerful town at the time, a manufacturing city, major corn processing plants, rail yards for miles, union jobs that kept families stable. The 1960 U.S. Census shows that Decatur was a strong working town. Median household income nationally hovered just over $5,000 per year, In Decatur, that meant honest homes, steady paychecks, and reputations that mattered. Structure was everything. Men worked. Women managed households. Families attended church. Absence was noticed. Nationally, violent crime was beginning to rise. FBI reports show that between 1960 and 1965, violent crime increased by nearly 20% across the United States. The national homicide rate in 1964 was approximately 4.9 per 100,000 people, lower than the modern peaks, but climbing. But statistics are abstract. A triple homicide inside of a family home with a hatchet? That wasn't abstract. That was personal. Friday night, late February 1964. As dinner was coming to an end, 19-year-old Michael Gambrill stared at his parents. His dad, 49-year-old Everett Gambrill, and his mother, Mary Elaine, 46 years old, told Michael that was enough talk for the night and nothing was going to change their minds. See, Michael had flown back from San Diego a few nights before. He was in the Marine Corps, and Michael didn't like it at all. He missed his family, missed freedom, and wanted change. But being in the Marine Corps, he couldn't do any of that. So Michael had an idea. He wanted his mom and dad to get him a British passport. He had been born in England to his Irish mother and believed returning to Ireland could help him escape the Marine Corps. This idea was shut down multiple times over the phone by Michael's mother and his father, so Michael felt maybe coming home and asking face to face would make them change their minds on everything. Michael had enlisted in the Marine Corps in September of 1963. He completed boot camp in San Diego, and his parents felt this was a great fit for Michael. But that changed quickly. For unknown reasons, he dropped out of his communication training program and was assigned to a mess hall duty as everything was figured out. Michael would go AWOL on February 24, 1964, and would return to Decatur on Wednesday, February 26. All felt normal at first. Michael would walk inside the family home, say hi to his mother, Mary, his father, Everett, and then he would walk down that small, narrow hallway to his 13-year-old sister's room. Annabelle was bedridden, though. She had major physical limitations. She also had CP. She had been ill for months. Her health was vastly declining, really not being able to eat or hear or even speak. The family knew that she didn't have much time. This brought emotion to Michael right away, seeing his sister in this state. The house wasn't big, but it was big enough for a small family. Michael did have one other brother, but he also had medical issues and was housed in the Lincoln, Illinois State Hospital for the Disabled. He was unable to speak and walk, and, well, much more. It was unknown if Michael was going to go see his brother on this trip back home. As a few days passed, Michael would still talk about getting that passport, and every time his parents would say no, and they didn't want to talk about it anymore. Friday, February 28th, late afternoon. As Michael's mom was prepping the night's dinner, Michael would spend time with his sister. Everett would make his way home from work, and the talk about the passport would come up again. Sitting at that dining room table, it would turn a little louder this time. As Everett would say this was enough, and we're done talking about this, he would slam his hands down on the table. He would get up and walk away. Dinner was unfinished, but he went to the back bedroom. Some say to cool down, some say to get ready for bed. We're not fully for sure, though. But we do know that Michael's mom, Mary, was also upset. So upset she turned away from the dining room table, too. She would make her way back to Annabella's room to comfort and lay down with her. As the family walked away from the table, Michael would just sit and think. A blank stare, empty thoughts, memories running. Michael then walks into the living room and sees a movie is about to start. It's getting kind of late, but it's a Friday night, and it's a scary movie. As the family sleeps, Michael watches and thinks more and more. Just after midnight, this movie would end. As the national anthem played, Michael would stare at that TV with another blank stare. And then the TV went into that white static noise. Michael would stand up and walk over to the TV and click it off. In Michael's own words in later interviews, that's when he got the urge to kill. This is when Michael walks into the kitchen and gets a butcher knife from the drawer. As he's holding it, he knew it wasn't going to work. It's not strong enough. He would place the knife on the countertop and head downstairs to the basement. This is where his duffel bag was. Inside was some clothes, some photos, and a hatchet. He knew this would work. And then Michael just snapped. He walked upstairs from the basement. The first room was his sister's room. As I mentioned before, his mom was sleeping in the bed with 13-year-old Annabella. Michael would take the hatchet to his mother first, violently attacking her. As Annabella lay awake in fear, not able to move, Michael would turn that hatchet to his sister, swinging so hard it severed her spinal cord in 3 spots. It was quick but loud. Michael's dad hears the commotion, gets out of bed, and starts to walk down the hallway. Michael overpowers his dad and swings over and over until his dad wasn't moving anymore. As the bodies lay throughout the house, Michael would walk back down that narrow hallway and return to the living room, sit down in the chair, and just stare. His thoughts, what did I do and why? He would start to clean himself up, but he knew he had to run. What to wear and how? So he walked outside early Saturday morning, and he steals his dad's 1958 Rambler, and he would start to drive away. Drive away from the slaughtering that took place only a few hours earlier. As Michael drove, the house sat dark and quiet. Not knowing where to go, he knew he had to drive as far as he could, which meant he was heading to Florida, and he wasn't going to stop till he got there. All day Saturday, no movement from the home. No car in the driveway, shades pulled down, just a quiet home. But no one really noticed, really. No notice came till Monday, March 3rd, shortly after 9 a.m. See, Michael's dad, Everett, was a janitor at Enterprise School. When Monday morning rolled around and school had started, there was some worry. Worry because there was no sign of Everett, which was not normal at all. Everett didn't miss any days of work, and the staff and kids noticed right away. The school officials tried to call home a few times and no answer. So they decided to have 5th grade teacher Gerard Weatherford and William Spencer, a substitute custodian, drive over to the 32nd Street home and see if everything was okay. When the pair showed up, nothing seemed off besides the house being closed up. No blinds open and just quiet, very quiet. As William walked around, someone called Reverend David McConaughey, which was the pastor at the family's Woodlawn Chapel Church. He had a major worry. He thought something really bad had happened because the family didn't show up for Sunday service, which was not normal. As the school staff returned to the school with no answers, the Reverend called the police. This is when Patrolman John Corley and Reverend McConaughey met at the home. As the patrolman slowly opened the door, he and the Reverend would have no idea what they're about to see. A thing of nightmares. Things you only should see in horror movies. Things no one should ever see. A bloodbath, death, and so many questions of why and who would do anything like this. Within minutes, the neighborhood is a crime scene. Newspaper reporters are flooding the area. Of course, this was 1960s and times were different, which meant everyone and anyone walked into that house to look at the crime scene. Reporters took photos of the bed in which Mary and her 13-year-old daughter Annabella had been hacked to death. As the police worked inside the house, some officers worked the area outside, looking for clues. The first major thing that jumped out was the missing car. And then one of the patrol officers noticed something shiny on the ground between the house and the garage. There on the ground was a cigarette lighter with the initials MG. When talking to the Reverend, who could this be? He knew right away. Michael Gambrill, their 19-year-old son. So the police went on a manhunt, taking any leads they could find. They wanted to speak to Michael. Did he do this? Is he hurt? They needed more information. As the local funeral home is pulling up 3 different hearses into the front yard to load the slain family into the back, Michael's in Florida driving to Fort Pierce when his stolen car has a blowout. With no spare tire, he decided to hitchhike. He rode in three separate cars before he made it to the Boynton Beach. He stopped to talk to a bridge tender. That tender warned him that he shouldn't be walking the streets at night because the police might pick him up. The man kindly gave Michael $1.50 for a bus fare. And as Michael was waiting for a bus, Sergeant William Hamilton stopped to question him. Michael said he was on leave. Of course, he didn't have any documents to prove this, so the sergeant took Michael down to the police station to get everything figured out. As Michael sat there in the police station, his thoughts running through his mind just overpowered him, and he broke down and confessed what he had done to his family in Decatur. The sergeant jumped on the phone and called Decatur police right away. Maybe this was another made-up story, the sergeant thought, but was blown away when the Decatur police captain said that Michael was wanted for questioning involved in a triple murder of his family. This was the lead the police needed. Now to get Michael back to Decatur. This would take a few days, and as it was getting worked out, local newspapers from Decatur to Florida had gotten word of this crime, and they all started to write about it. It made headlines in all the papers. One of those headlines got back to some detectives in San Diego. They wanted to question Michael too, about a possible murder that had taken place on February 5th. A young Alabama serviceman and his wife had been honeymooning in the city, and then they'd been found shot to death in their beds in the middle of the night. With Michael in San Diego at the time, the police thought the murders were similar enough to the Decatur killings to warrant a few questions. The San Diego police would question Michael, and Michael would hold his ground and deny any involvement, which later on would be noted, and he was not a suspect of that murder. Decatur law enforcement would have Michael flown to Indianapolis, in which two police officers in unmarked cars drove him back to Decatur. Back in Decatur, Michael was being photographed and fingerprinted at the jail. As the funeral services for his murdered family was being put together by the Dawson and Wyckoff funeral home. About a half an hour after his arrival, he was taken before Judge James R. Palmer, who explained his rights, and Gambrill entered a plea of not guilty to three murder charges against him. The not guilty pleas were mandated on Palmer's part since he did not have the authority to accept a guilty plea on murder charges. He ordered Michael to be held without bond. The state was represented during the arguments by State Attorney Basil Grannis. Although Michael did not yet have an attorney, a public defender was appointed to him shortly later. First on the agenda for Michael was a mental health exam, which was used to determine further actions in his case. To understand if he would be legally sane, he would be prosecuted on one or more of the murder charges that had been filed against him. If doctors believed he was insane at the time of the killing, he would be sent to the Illinois Security Hospital at Menard Prison. He was taken to Springfield, Illinois for his mental exams, and the reports from the state doctors showed that he was legally sane. Plans were made to present Michael's case to a grand jury on April 6, where the state's attorney felt he would be indicted. Soon after, Michael appeared in front of Judge Lester Brinkotter and his public defender Albert E. Hurt. Brinkotter ordered the hearing delayed for a week to give Michael time to discuss charges with his attorney. Hurt later waived the hearing, which was not opposed by the state's attorney. He said that he saw no reason why the case would not go to trial as soon as possible. He also did not foresee any plans for a sanity hearing regarding Michael's mental health. Trial date was set for May 18, 1964, a little over 3 months since the crime took place. On Monday, May 18th at 9 a.m., Michael appeared in court for his hearing in the custody of the Sheriff's Department. He was also accompanied by the pastor, Reverend David McConaughey. The pastor, friends, and former teachers and other people that associated with Michael had recently been interviewed by the newspapers about the young man. The Reverend described him as moody, but said that he didn't give off any outward signs that he had a bad temper or that he was going to kill his whole entire family. The Reverend said he had always believed that Michael had a rebellious streak and he only attended church because of his parents, but all that changed after he joined the Marine Corps. Before leaving for boot camp, Michael would often show up at church with his father See, his dad also worked part-time at that church. And on some Saturday afternoons, Michael would just talk with the pastor. The Reverend described Michael as a boy who liked being alone and someone who would not reveal his true feelings. Others agreed, and those who knew him stated that he was quiet and musically inclined. He had some problems in school, although none were serious, and he had always appeared to be an introverted student. His former principal at Eisenhower High School, Marvell Barnes, said Michael appeared to be a younger person who lived in a shell and refused to be drawn into school activities. Chief Deputy Sheriff Chris Ballas stated that Michael conducted himself as a model prisoner at the Macon County Jail, spending most of his time exercising in the common area and reading in his cell. He didn't mix much with the other prisoners and spent most of his time by himself. His aunt from Minneapolis brought him reading materials on rock collecting, and she would visit as much as she could. When she did visit, she was sometimes joined by the Reverend. The deputy did say he was well behaved, but added that to his knowledge, Michael never expressed any remorse about the hatchet slayings. It's not for sure if Michael did have remorse or just time to think about what he had done, because Michael would change his plea from innocent to guilty. Not three murder charges, though, only one, the murder of his sister. The DA and public defender, along with Michael, agreed to plea on a single count of murder, which would shorten any sentence that he might have received for all three murders. After talking this over with the judge in the chambers and a formal reading of new charges in court, Michael's plea was changed to one count of guilty. The charges of murder to his mother and father were dismissed. After assuring that Michael understood the nature of charges and the penalty that it could be imposed, he sentenced Michael to 50 to 100 years in prison. "It is my opinion," Judge Morthland said, "that because of the nature of the crime, the defendant, Michael Gambrill, should never again be released into society." With that powerful statement from the judge, he would be shocked with what would come years later. It was noted that the doctors asked Michael if he felt that it was wrong when he killed his parents and sister. And Michael said, "I didn't really feel anything. When I started, I couldn't stop attacking." Michael was noted as having a higher than average IQ, and the doctors all stated they had been shocked by the total lack of remorse for his crimes. Dr. Melvin Sieglin, a psychiatrist from Chicago, also examined Michael but did not submit a full report to the courts. He was asked by a reporter after the sentencing whether a 19-year-old boy could live with the fact that he killed his parents and his sister. "I think he already has," Dr. Siegel said. Michael was taken away to spend what Judge Morthland believed to be a life sentence, only becoming eligible for parole after 20 years, which in everyone's eyes, who would let a hatchet-murdering madman out of prison? Well, on December 5th, 2005, Michael was able to leave prison. As I say this, your first thoughts are that he died. I'm here to tell you no. He left alive and married. Yes, married. See, while in prison, Michael became an ideal prisoner, worked in the church, made friends, fell in love with someone very close to him. So close that this person knew what happened to Michael's family. Why and how, you ask? Well, it was her family too. Michael married his second cousin, the same cousin that he's still married to this day. Michael will be turning 81 years old this coming May of 2026. A man that got the urge to kill on one cold February night in 1964, now is someone's neighbor. You know that old man across the street that you wave at? Could it be Michael? Just maybe. Or maybe not. It's hard to tell. It makes you think. How well do you know your neighbor? Thanks for listening to American Dread. I'm your host, Adam White. American Dread is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. See you later.